We've had many guests here in the studio who are repeat champions, and one of those people is none other than Chris White. He's a retired U.S. Army military intelligence officer and a foreign area specialist for sub-Saharan Africa. He served as the director of African studies at the U.S. Army War College and was the senior military advisor of the U.S. mission to the African Union. So the man knows us better than we know ourselves in some ways. And it's always good when he's around because he spends a lot of time between here and the United States. But you really like South Africa, which I don't think we've covered in a previous episode. We always get straight into the politics and we start talking about, you know, your involvement in this and the controversy over this tweet or something else.
Not my tweets.
but what I love is that you keep coming back here. You have a deep attachment to South Africa. You're pretty much an honorary citizen, although I don't think that our extant government would be thrilled to give you, full citizenship. So what is it that keeps drawing you back here, Chris? Tell us about that before we get into everything else.
Well, Renato Jose claims I'm here for the oil, but I need to get him in touch with some geologists. There's no oil here.
So you're here for the oil. Yeah. Well, there might be in the Karoo if we just bothered to frack, and there might be offshore
if you let Shell drill. Yeah. Yes. But no, he jokes about that for a long time, and then I joke in my program I'm looking for Bournemouth. But I haven't had a single one chat me up yet, so it's a mission failure across the board. But to answer the question directly, seriously, I as a young man was I lived in poverty in high school. We didn't have electricity, fetched water from a cistern, used a outdoor privy to go to the restroom.
By the way, people don't think that happens in America. It happens more than people would like to think.
Yeah. It's not necessary. America has the resources. So it's just like South Africa shouldn't be in the mess it's in today. It has all the resources, human capital, natural resources.
Where in the U.S. was that?
That was in Appalachia in southeastern Ohio.
Okay.
So I ran a dairy farm, a small dairy farm with Jerseys, which are very docile, lovely cattle. But I didn't have much money. And so when I was in school, I took all the classes I could so I'd get out of school and get away from my childhood as quickly as possible. And what happened was I'd go to the library. I had a lot of free time during the day. And I look at atlases and gazetteers and Liechtenstein, Monaco, the Vatican City, all these, Andorra, these postage stamp countries.
You would be a handy person to have in a general knowledge geography quiz.
Oh, yeah. I've usually done quite well at those. Sure. So I don't know. Maybe not now, but I've done well in the past. So I would be very interested in that. And then I became interested in military history. But I started following Rhodesia and Angola and Mozambique. And that's when, after the Carnation Revolution in Portugal, and they were cut loose, and Rhodesia, you know, under Ian Smith, was still going on. And I read these in weekly magazines, and then I found it very fascinating. And so I already had some interest in Africa because of that. And then around 1980, I think it was, when I was a sophomore in high school, if I recall correctly, I got a book from James Michener called The Covenant. And The Covenant was named after Geloof de Dag, the Day of the Vow.
Right.
So James Michener was a historical fiction writer who would take real people, real events, and he would mix them with fictional characters, and then he would weave a story. And The Covenant's 1,200 pages long, fine print paperback. It's quite a novel to get through. But I was engrossed by it. I read the whole book. I still have my copy. The binding is curled up together.
That's how you know a book is really loved.
Exactly. I've read it four times over the years. But I read it and I said, "Wow, what a crazy screwed up country this is."
Well, not because I think my audience is particularly illiterate when it comes to history, but because there might be people who've joined us for the first time today, and maybe people who sometimes listen to you, sometimes listen to me. But let's just talk about Geloof de Dag, because that's Day of the Vow. It happens in December, mid-December. It's actually the promise being fulfilled, the covenant of the Afrikaans people who fought at Blood River against the Zulu army of overwhelming numbers, which they defeated. Blood River, of course, a well-known episode in South African history. The promise that was made was by Cyril Cilia, who was the spiritual leader of the Boers at that point. The military leader and the commanding officer was Andries Pretorius. Cyril Cilia said, gathered everybody together, "If we win this, God will build you a church." And the church is the Church of the Vow in Pietermaritzburg. And that's the basis for this novel?
Well, that's where the title came from. That's not the basis for it. The basis for it is the history of South Africa. So Michener would go back to the formation of the earth. That's how early he begins his stories.
Good heavens.
Yes, I told you it was 1,200 pages long. But he goes from there. Now, I've found some information recently that apparently maybe he didn't write it. It was written by a South African. It was ghostwritten. Yeah, that's news to me. I didn't know that. An old article that some South African did. But whatever the case is, it's an incredible
sales book. For this book are going to shoot up after this. You've made it sound so mysterious.
He's been dead for 30 years. But I know it's a fantastic book, but it really engrossed me in South Africa. And you're right, Tom, that day. But that they just picked that to name the book for the title. But it takes the whole history, and it takes a fictional American South African family, which is a weird angle.
Yeah.
The Saltwood family. And it's kind of weird. But what I discovered is what a fascinating country full of all kinds of people, but what a screwed up place. And then
we're not going to be offended. Carry on.
That was 1980. It was pretty screwed up. So then I went to university and I was introduced to rugby as a freshman early in the term. And I knew what rugby was, but you know, we were excited to have paved roads and electricity where I lived at. So that was kind of new, you know, kind of like Stanton. you should have seen a pothole I went through a little while ago. I had to check the tire. My goodness. Anyway, but seriously, I discovered rugby at university, and there's a whole story behind that, which is probably not for a PG audience, so we'll save that. But that got me even more interested in South Africa, because as a history student and later historian, I wanted to support a rugby side. We didn't have a national side in 1982. Our team in 1920 and 1924 that went to the Olympics was a bunch of college kids. They just grabbed off of California campuses and sent to Paris, and we won gold, double gold medal winner.
Wow. American rugby.
Yeah,
we
were the defending world champions in Olympic rugby until 2016 when
South Africa got back in it.
Yes, but South Africa didn't win. Fiji won that one, if I recall correctly. But we were defending for nearly a century because there was no rugby in the Olympics.
Right.
So I got interested in rugby, and then a couple of years after that, after I became fluent in German, which is my second language among the many, I realized that learning a language, you learn a lot about
people. How many languages? You can't just breeze past that. So we've got
I speak six languages to varying degrees of proficiency. I used to speak four fluently.
What are they?
Well, I speak English. I have to count that.
Go on.
German, French, Afrikaans, Setswana, and Swahili.
Wow.
Yeah. And I tell people I don't speak Afrikaans because...
How's your Setswana?
That's it's impressive. Really sad and rusty. It was. I lived in Botswana. Okay, Botswana.
Okay.
No, I used to live in Botswana. It's a fantastic place. And so that's one of the reasons why in South Africa, what I do is I try to promote a couple of cultural groups. So I promote Afrikaans. I promote the Setswana because it's the cousins of the Tswana, same people. And then Sotho, but less to a lesser degree because they're cousins. When I go to Maseru, I can say Otsihili Jang and they know what I'm saying. But when they answer back, I understand some of it, not all of it, but it's close enough.
Okay.
So yeah, I went from there, the rugby, and I started, once I learned German, I started self-teaching myself Afrikaans. And I got asked the same question in the 1980s. When I started following rugby, I picked a team and I couldn't go with England, couldn't go with France, couldn't go with Australia, New Zealand. And I thought maybe Scotland or Ireland to be the team I support because we didn't have a team.
Right.
And I said, well, I'm interested in Africa. I looked, the Springboks had a storied history. Springboks, what are you, racist? It's rugby. Get over yourself. So then when I started learning Afrikaans, like, what are you, racist? I'm like, you do realize that most people that speak this are brown, right? I mean, you know, it's the first language, more people that are brown than so. Anyway, and that's kind of where this started. I went in the army after a year of college of kind of screwing around because I didn't have much money. And then I came back from college and I went and studied history again in German. And what I did is I studied mostly African history. And and then later my postgraduate work, I did political science, international relations.
Put up that comment quickly before this one, the one about how Chris knows more about African history than most of we do. The Colonel knows more about Africa and the world than people in general and here. Really cares about humanity. I think that's very badly written, mental chewing gum, but I get the gist of it. Could have been written by someone who's just hit their head really hard. So you should be called mental bumping your head.
Careful now. That's a potential or actual existing view of mine. Don't accept
all right. Okay. But still, I mean, they
yes, it could have been more clever.
Maybe they're just woken up. Let's give them a chance.
Let's give them that.
Okay. All right. So all of this, I mean, first of all, I commend you on your love for history and clearly for languages and culture. Because it's something which I don't feel too many people are putting too much effort into. People will claim it when they feel that it's useful to them. But history and culture are things that need tending. They're things that you don't just claim when they're useful to you, when they'll help you win an argument or when it gives you an advantage over someone else, or when you want to be excluded from something because it's uncomfortable and weird. So you...
This sounds like
cultural.
South Africa.
This is South Africa. And there's so much of this that goes on, right? I was on a podcast not so long ago, which is very different to this one, where we were talking about family history and kind of where everybody comes from. And it strikes me as weird that we live in a country where people talk about the ancestors. black and white, mm-hmm. and our ancestral claims to things like land and, you know, our culture. It's our culture to do this or our culture to do that. These are the same people who've done no research into their own history or culture. They pay scant attention to it. Most of them are not even aware of who their grandparents were, what their names were, where they lived, what they did. But they'll claim culture and history to be on their side when it suits them from a political point of view. Always strange and I think quite dishonest way of behaving.
I'd agree 100%. You know, that's the thing. Strange thing has happened since the end of apartheid. History has been distorted in a very poor fashion. It may have been distorted prior to that, but, you know, an interesting
thing. It certainly was.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that since 1994, it's flipped the other direction and it's just as reprehensible. Hmm. You know, people being taught that they should be ashamed of who they are. I have a friend whose 9-year-old daughter came home crying from school and says, I don't want to be an Offer Connor anymore.
Well,
that's terrible.
Again, this came up in that same discussion I had with Ernst von Sale of AfriForum, because I said to him there was this epidemic of bizarre Afrikaans names after 1994, which were not Afrikaans names, but were attempts at
creating exoticizing. A cultural
thing. Yeah. But also distancing themselves from their own culture and history. Mm-hmm. You have Afrikaans kids with names that just are not Afrikaans in any which way.
Don't make any sense.
Yeah. And it seems to me very odd. And then I suddenly thought, oh no, but I understand that. It's little girls like that crying who want to distance themselves from their own ancestry, their own yeah. background, their own history, their own deep.
Which is sad. You know, Steve Biko talked about black consciousness. You shouldn't be ashamed of who you are. You should be comfortable in your skin.
Absolutely.
Everyone should feel that way.
Yeah. And I think that we have overcompensated in the opposite direction. There's propaganda before 1994 that made a version of history up, which just wasn't true and was dangerous and divisive and not particularly interesting, if you ask me, because I remember learning it at school and it wasn't fun. Even though I loved history, I was primed to be a really good history student. The stuff we were learning and the way it was taught was just awful. And then post 94, it seems that there's been an overcompensation in the other direction where we aren't paying attention to anything but 1994. And sadly,
well, you're not alone. The world,
sadly, the mess that's happened since, but we're not alone in the world.
No, you're not alone. The world is stuck on April 27th, 1994. That's one of the reasons why things have been allowed to degrade so much in South Africa. And what's happened here has happened because the world's not paying attention for the most part. They're not paying attention to events in South Africa.
Well, everyone, we know, America has the Rainbow Nation for the longest time.
Well, not just America, but generally Europe is the same thing. Japan. I mean, there's relations and there's ties, but many of the things that are happening, the violation of human rights, the deterioration in crime, the safety that's taking place here, the massive looting, the world's not really paying attention to South Africa.
Why are you? why are you paying attention there?
You sound like an Afrikaner. You're very suspicious.
No, I'm not suspicious. I know that your intentions are good because I've got to know you.
Yeah.
And I think that you are you're a person of, first of all, you don't hide the ball. No. If you want to say something or you have a point of view and you think it's worth saying, you say it. So I don't think there's any nefarious intent there. Second of all, you're not here for the oil, despite the people who say that. And you're not a representative of some dark arm of the diplomatic service.
No.
I mean, you're a private citizen who mm-hmm. takes an interest, and you're a lot of the audience that you've built up over time have decided that they're also interested in these things, mostly because you put a compelling story together.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So
why am I interested?
So why are you interested?
Well, I mean, frankly, South Africa is a very compelling story. It's a fascinating story. There's a lot of parallels between South Africa's development and America's development, including slavery, also the frontier pioneer spirit. You know, now that's not just the Afrikaners. I mean, if the Bantu speaking groups in this country, the Nguni speaking peoples, are honest about their history, they're also pioneers. Yeah. They came down the Rift Valley.
Yeah, which is something to be proud of.
Exactly. They came all the way down. They came through over the Limpopo and the Zambezi River. They settled in what became South Africa. The history wasn't always good, but there was still a history here.
They established themselves in various groups as particularly powerful conquerors in some ways.
Indeed.
I mean, the Zulu certainly have an extraordinarily proud history. Of course, history now has become how the victim nations and the victim tribes and the victim organizations through history are the ones that we should shed special light on, because our shame. But actually, there were lots of stories of tremendous victory, conquest, and against overwhelming odds in some cases, triumph. There's nothing wrong with celebrating that, especially if it's your people.
No, absolutely. And so there's that history that comes down, which is completely neglected by most people. There are some scholars who follow this, like Dr. John LeBond. He's one of them. You know him.
Yes.
There are some who cover this, but that history is largely ignored by the very people who are the descendants of those folks. It's kind of a shame. And then you have Europeans arriving in the Western Cape, and they move eastwards and wind up in conflict and then move northwards. And that frontier spirit, the faith, family, flag, it's kind of a thing that's same with America. We move from the East Coast of America as a population and populated the entire continent. Now, yes, there were some people there already, and some were assimilated, some were wiped out, and many of them are still there today. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is that the way that the country was founded and how it was founded, faith was a big part of it, both countries.
Yeah.
And independence was a huge part of it. People picked up and moved.
You've just hit a nerve, because I'm on a group with some friends, and one of them asked a friend of mine who's just moved to Texas. He lives there now in Dallas, and he's very happy in America, Afrikaans. Another friend of ours asked on the group, do you see any similarities? Do you see any crossover, which I think you're hinting at here too, between the Boers, Afrikaners of, you know, the 1800s and the American Western explorer, pioneer types?
Absolutely, 100%.
Prospectors. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was
mining even, as well. Yeah, we had the same thing.
There's mining too. So what are those similarities? Because I think that they're part of the reason that South Africa and America have struck up some sort of conversation in the last while. Not everybody's favorite kind of conversation, it deserves to be said, but something nonetheless.
Well, and that's why I go back to the Nguni speaking peoples, because there's also the similar tie there. But there's a very direct correlation, a more recent correlation, because it's happening at the same time. The four trekkers were leaving from the Cape and heading up into the interior. And of course, that's during the Mfukane and just total chaos. And so they mistakenly thought they were entering an almost empty land at the time. And what wound up happening is that they wound up allying themselves many times, because the Ndebele, who didn't want to be part under Mzilikazi, a part of the Zulu, they'd moved up into the Highveld, and they were preying on other tribes up there because they're more powerful. So the Baralong and the Bakwena and the other Tswana speakers, as well as Basutu tribes and the Griqua, who were in the area around Kimberley, would oftentimes ally themselves with the four trekkers. So the history there, and it had a similar history with America, with some pioneers moving westward, some Native American groups would ally with the pioneers, others would be against them. And you pick up and you're in wagons, you take everything you have and you put it all at risk and you go. And there's evil people all around you, and not just people who are different from you, but also people who are your own, who want to swindle you and take advantage of you. And, you know, it's a very, very much a direct parallel between the history of the United States and South Africa. And so, you know, it's the civil rights movement finally got a lot of traction under the Eisenhower administration in the 50s, which doesn't get credit for it, because the Democrats successfully stopped civil rights legislation until the 60s when they were in charge. They could take credit for it. Evil people. But they are just evil people. Demon rats.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've also got to you can only do so much PR and rebranding for yourself.
Yeah,
that's true. And the Democrats have tried and used up all of it. But we've got to remember, too, that prior to, I think you could say, Kennedy, Johnson, around there, the Democrats were the party of slavery, the party of
Jim Crow,
standing against civil rights, Jim Crow.
The Klan.
They were all Democrats. Well, and they did a massive rebrand after Kennedy.
They sure
tried.
The first Democratic president was Andrew Jackson, who removed the Seminole, the Choctaw, and the Cherokee Indians, stole their land in the Southeast, and moved them to Oklahoma on the Trail of Tears, where thousands died in the dead of winter. And that's the first modern Democratic Party president. That's the guy who speculated and became incredibly wealthy as president from land he stole from Native American tribes.
Well, we'll get into U.S. politics in a minute. So let's just fast forward a little bit, because there are things that I'm sure your audience want to hear from you, and that people who are listening here to this show every week want to hear, because you're well-informed on these things. So we've just had, and this is in the news at the moment, we've just had this disastrous withdrawal of South African troops and equipment from the DRC, where we've been embedded for God knows how long, doing God knows what. And it appears to some people that this is not only an unmitigated failure of military strategy, deployment, planning, administration,
and even
political intention, because we're not even sure what anyone was doing there. But it is a humiliation that we should be up in arms about with our own government. We our own citizens who have been sent there as soldiers have come back with their tail between their legs. And we have nothing but egg on our face here. It's very, very embarrassing. What do you think happened here? And are there certain facts that are starting to emerge around the reasons for our being there in the first place?
Well, it raises a very good question, I believe, and that's what is the role of South Africa's military? You know, it has a role to defend its national borders.
Which we don't do.
No.
I mean, our borders are open.
They are open. There used to be 7 South African infantry companies who patrol your borders with Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Swaziland, Lesotho, any given moment. Right now, there would be 7 companies out there patrolling. They don't have the resource to do it anymore, so they don't bother doing it. So what's the role? Well, under Mandela, it became a bit of a role in peacekeeping and peacemaking. So you know, it's interesting because South African politicians like to complain about Americans, say we're colonialist and we're adventurous and we're always deploying our military. But let's look at South Africa's history under the ANC. Operation Bolias, they deployed to Lesotho twice.
Yep.
They left the Botswana Defense Force high and dry. They were supposed to move their equipment and provide resources and petrol. Didn't do any of that stuff. In fact, in one of the villages, I've talked to a few BDF soldiers about this. They were on patrol. And remember, this is just post-94, just a few years after. So you had the Pan-African Congress, their troops, and you had also all the Bantustans all migrated together. So there was a lot of confusion in the new SANDF because they were still sorting things out. But they went up to a Lesotho village. And of course, in Lesotho, people are well known for carrying firearms. I mean, that's their cultural history. That's how they survived as a nation. Mishweshwe went up into the hills.
Correct.
So guys walk around with rifles and shotguns. Well, somebody's shotgun misfired, and the South African troops dropped their rifles apparently and ran away. The BDF soldiers on patrol with them are like, where are they going? So that was there. Then South African military has deployed to Comoros 2 or 3 times since then to deal with things there. They've sent troops to Eritrea and Ethiopia. They sent troops to Burundi and a presidential protection unit. They've sent troops to the Central African Republic, which we know was a debacle. And they've sent troops to Mozambique. And now there's troops in the CAR, the CAR. And they've been there before.
The Central African Republic.
I meant to say DRC.
Yeah, but the Central African Republic, we also had that disaster.
It was. A lot of troops killed there, too.
Where we had people killed, and we still don't know the reasons for it. We don't know what our men were deployed there to do, whether it was an African Union effort to try and bring stability to the place. The Russians, if not ISIS in the form of Al-Shabaab on the east coast and Boko Haram on the west, seem to be the guys who are really in control from an insurgency point of view in most of these places. And I say the Russians because the Russians have various economic and political interests across this continent. Of course, I think since the outbreak of the Ukraine war, since they invaded Ukraine, Russia has less time and money and effort to put in here. But they're still very involved, right? I mean, still Antonov aircraft flying into strange places with strange names, dropping off equipment, troops, special operations people.
Well, and the guy that was deeply involved in this, of course, was Prigozhin, or how we pronounce his name.
Who was killed, yeah.
It was killed. The guy who could
suspicious little plane accident.
Yeah, just on the heels of his non-invasion of Moscow. You know, he traveled further in 18 hours with his troops towards Moscow than the Wehrmacht did in 4 months in 1941. I mean, if he'd been serious, Putin would have been gone.
Yeah.
There was nothing
left.
That's
why he's gone.
Yeah, well, exactly. There was nothing left to stop him from getting to Moscow. Who knows what would happen, But his exit from the stage has had a big impact on the Wagner Group not being as active in Africa. That's a big part of it. But yeah, the question is, why is South Africa's military doing this?
Yeah, well, particularly with the DRC. Maybe you can let's get that one out of the way.
Sure. Well, let me go back to the previous iteration when a lot of African militaries found themselves in DRC about 25 years ago. They all went there ostensibly to help the government, you know, stop, you know, what was going on in the eastern part of the country. But the reality is that the Namibian Defense Force, the Zimbabwe Defense Force in particular, and others were there for minerals. The generals all got fat and rich off of the money that was made off the minerals that were stolen, exported out of there.
The generals and the government.
Of course, the government. Of course, yes. Yes. So I'm not claiming that's the case with South Africa. South Africa has been involved with the DRC for a long time. But the history of the SANDF has been bad.
So in other words, they were doing no better than King Leopold of Belgium was.
Aside from not chopping hands off, yes, it's pretty much horrible. Yeah. They're running prostitution rings, running drug rings, you know. preying on people. It's a really bad history, and it's gone on since the 60s, but especially since the 1990s when they overthrew Mobutu. But it's really been a mess. And why they're there now is there's a SADC mission that was created in 2023, Southern African Development Community, to go in there to replace a UN mission that was leaving, that the president didn't want there anymore. So he agreed to have the SADC mission come in from Southern African countries. And I'm not really sure what they want to accomplish here. It doesn't make any sense. They were poorly equipped, under-equipped. Their medevac procedures virtually non-existent. Look, I've seen the videos. And look, it's anecdotal. I'm not there on the ground. So I've seen the videos of South African soldiers just wildly firing into the air. No fire discipline. And just one NCO who's trying to get control and get them to behave themselves. I'm not trying to denigrate the South African Defense Force. But when you spend 0.8 or 0.9% of your GDP on the military, that's counterproductive. You produce a force that's ill-disciplined, ill-equipped, and unprepared to do anything. And that's what you have today. You know, you have two Gripens that are operational and one qualified pilot to fly both of them. Jan van Riebeck had a bigger Navy when he landed in Cape Town than the South African Navy has operational today. There's like one of the Corvettes in Durban that goes out a couple kilometers to get sea time and comes back. I watched it last year. I can watch it go out of the port. I'm like, oh, they're going to sea. Nope. They hung around for about 10 minutes. They came back to port. They get paid sea pay because they went out there. Or maybe they had a mechanical problem. I don't know. And then your submarines are basically sitting in dry dock. Mm-hmm. Type 209 diesel submarines, the best diesel submarines on the planet, built by Germans. They're doing nothing.
Well, there was an inverted commas air show over my house over the weekend. I know because I couldn't not hear it. But almost all the planes were private planes, held by private collectors or enthusiasts.
Indeed.
Aviation.
Because you can't get military planes in the air.
Sure. So,
and the irony juxtaposes against Trump wants a big military parade over DC. You're going to see a lot of jets flying over DC very soon.
And that's going to frighten the hell out of some people because they think he's just determined to run for a third term or be a dictator for life. All right. So it's embarrassing. And lives have been lost.
Indeed. That's
and,
the sad part.
And we've got a minister in the form of Angie Motshekga who's moved from portfolio to portfolio, just leaving devastation in her wake. We just really don't have a military to speak of. I think we have more private security people in this country.
750,000 employed in private security.
Than we have military and police combined.
Yeah, the military and police combined is just a little. You have 180,000 police, including constables, and then detectives, and the leadership and the mechanics. So 180,000 roughly, and then you've got about 60,000 military. So
is that all we've got? 60,000 soldiers of every kind.
That's about it.
Air Force, Navy, Army. My God, that's frightening. 60,
well, what's 000. Even more frightening is when you look at SAPs at any given moment right now.
There are more people who work the tills at Checkers than there are people.
There might be more people working at Wimpy. No, but if you take right now, this very moment in time, best case, you have 40 to 45,000 police patrolling somewhere in this country. A country of this size with 63 million people. That's a joke. That's a ratio that's way under the international norm. It's not enough police, even if they're all honest, well-equipped, and well-motivated and well-paid.
Which we know they're not.
Which none of that, most of that's not true. So it's really sad. And you wonder why there's crime. Not only is there an unwillingness to prosecute violent crime and deter people from, but with real, when you get life, it's supposed to be life, not 15 years. You know, that's
our correctional services are also a disaster.
Well, I feel for Peter Hrenovog. He took on a poison chalice.
I feel for him, but I don't know whether his hands are tied or whether government is just impossible. I don't know, because there should be progress of a kind being made there too. All right, so let's just talk about you some more, Chris, because you do, as you've just demonstrated, you know a lot about what's going on. You're able to share facts. You're able to share information. A little bit of what you give is opinion, but most of it is just telling the story as you see it and where you find it. And yet, I hear that you're a very dangerous person from some people on the internet, and in particular in the mainstream media. I hear that you're extraordinarily dangerous. You're an agent for someone, some unknown dark force. I mean, maybe this is the time you just tell us the truth.
Well, rumor is I work for the CIA, and I do. I can confirm that.
Yeah.
Chris in Africa.
Okay, yeah. But you don't work. I mean, you used to advise the U.S. government on what happens here.
Yes, I was
you don't have any
officer.
Formal role there at all anymore.
No, in fact, I tried to have a formal role in government last year. I foolishly ran for the state legislature in Pennsylvania.
I remember it.
And I lost badly. Yeah. Well, the problem is that everything's local, and it's a local election. If it had been for Congress, it might have been different. But at the local election, it's like, you know, did you know Marley back in 1978 sort of thing?
It's just, like, so, it's just like politics all over
exactly,
the world.
As Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. And so, but it was a lot of my viewers asked me to do it, U.S. and even people in South Africa. They want to see me run for office.
Right.
And it was a time I was going to use as a platform to go after the former governor who violated human rights. So that's because I wanted to put a bill on the floor to overturn his qualified immunity because he put COVID positive patients in our nursing homes.
Which governor was that?
Governor Tom Wolf.
Okay. I remember him.
Yeah. So he put all these COVID positive patients in our nursing homes, killing our grandparents, our uncles, and aunts. And there's been no accountability.
Cuomo did in New York.
And Murphy did in New Jersey. Right. They all must have got together.
All these compassionate Democrats, huh?
Exactly. So they just all idiots.
But in terms of South Africa, you don't have a diplomatic role. You're not informing anybody. You're informing all of us. We can all sign up for your channel.
If you like.
Right.
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I did. There were a few mechanisms if you want to be in an incoming administration. I did submit my name, threw it in the hat to be the ambassador of South Africa. Of course, everybody thought Joel Pollack, except me. I didn't think it was going to be Joel Pollack.
Yeah.
So I put my name in for that. But the Trump administration does know who I am. I'm a nobody.
And what do we know about this Brent Bazell guy who's going to be our ambassador?
Brent Bazell is a fantastic guy, very smart guy. He started this media research company years ago to counter
to be clear, he's going to be the U.S. ambassador here.
Well, he's the nominee. He's got to be confirmed, but he will be confirmed.
And South Africa, we've decided we're sending
Mkabisi Jonas as a special envoy.
Mkabisi Jonas, who hasn't said great things about Donald Trump, which is not a good place to start. But anyway.
It's a bad start, but it may not be the end of the world. But he's going to have a hard time getting office calls as a challenge.
Sure.
Because he's irritated some people. But there is some advantages to him going, and that's that he has the ear of Ramaphosa. He has no political ambitions that we know of, so he's probably not a threat to anybody on the National Executive Committee for the ANC and a threat to the government. So if you're not a threat and you have the ear of the president, maybe you can be effective.
You could be useful.
Yeah, so maybe.
So tell me about Bozell.
So Brent Bozell was started a media research company, I think that's the name of it, years ago, and he was a frequent guest on Fox News exposing the hypocrisy in media and in government, the leftist hypocrisy for years. He's a conservative. He is a supporter of Israel, but I mean, Joel Pollack is really, really in the tank with Israel. Nothing wrong with that, mm-hmm. from my perspective, but
sure.
But coming to South Africa, that's going to be a very difficult relationship to start with because of that affinity for Israel, because, you know, the Naledi Pandor crowd that's still in the government. So Brent Bozell, really smart guy, and he's probably a good pick for the position. I think he's the right pick.
Okay. When does he start?
Well, yes, be confirmed. And once he's confirmed, then he goes through his charm school to be an ambassador, which apparently Ibrahim forgot about. I didn't bring my shirt in. Bring my shirt, and I got a shirt in the car. I was going to show it to you. It says Rasooled. I coined the verb, and one of my viewers at one of my meet greets You've been Rasooled, yes. Anyway, it's a shame. He knew better. Come on. He was in D.C. before. He knows better. I thought it was intentional, but I found that maybe it's not really intentional. He kind of put his foot out there and put his foot in his mouth and realized that when he did it.
Tell me about Trump tariffs, in your opinion, because I think this is a major misstep of this administration. There are 100 days and some change in, and I mean, really, you can't argue that Trump. I saw David Sachs on the All In podcast saying that you can't argue that his immigration policy hasn't been an overwhelming success already. In 100 days, he's
unless you're a Democrat,
he's basically shut down immigration. Illegal immigration,
correct. Not legal America. Immigration.
No,
continues,
no. People don't have a problem with legal immigration,
but it continues. Yes.
Yeah. Let's be straight up about this. Americans have never said we don't want anyone coming to our country. It's a nation of immigrants.
The pillage the world of your qualified nurses and doctors.
Sure. I mean, qualified people. Trump is even offering like a gold card to people who will be willing to bring millions and billions of dollars to the country. If you bring that money in, he'll make you a citizen.
Yeah.
But illegal immigration, a major issue with the election. Trump said, we'll shut down the border. We'll stop them from coming. We'll deport the bad guys. It seems they've done that. I mean,
illegal
immigration's right down. And there are no crossings that were happening every day under Biden. He was out of control when he was president.
Was out of control when Obama was president as well. But Obama was actually deporting a lot of people. He has the record for deportations, President Obama. Yeah, which
and the
they never talked about that.
Too.
He's the one to put them in cages, and he's the one who supported more people than any other administration in history, and they never talked about that.
I was told that the only bad man in the world is Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, that's what you get from me.
All right, so immigration aside, illegal immigration.
Sure.
I don't understand what kind of a game and people tell me he's playing 4D chess and it's beyond me, and I'm willing to accept that I might be stupid on this. But it seems to me that the tariff thing instead of being a way for America to protect strategic manufacturing, like, you know, weapons, steel, all that kind of thing, which would be a good idea to do, and in terms of trying to exercise as much hegemony as America's usually had in the world, especially with respect to China. I understand tariffs and regulations around trade in those respects, but I do not get why you would punish your allies and threaten the world with a big stick. And then when the world comes to you with deals, you don't give them those deals and you say you're the big deal maker. Is this a misstep in your opinion, or am I just seeing half the story?
Well, it's a fair question. It's certainly controversial, to say the least. So let's talk about why Trump uses tariffs first off. Yeah. But before I do, let me say, if I were king for the day, if I were in Trump's shoes, I would have handled a bit differently. I wouldn't have just done this broad-based reciprocal tariffs. I would have targeted countries like China,
right,
and specific European Union countries that they're doing this. So
they're treating us very badly.
They are. Look, we've been suckers for decades, and we've allowed our corporate titans to ship our industrial base to Asia for a few fractions of margin on profit, which is ridiculous. I mean, what kind of concept is that? You ship all your jobs overseas. How are people back here going to buy those products in the end? They have no jobs.
Yeah.
So why is Trump doing it? Well, first off, Trump sees tariffs as a cudgel, as a tool to get what he wants. So three cases where tariffs have worked recently and people have completely missed this. They're missing the boat or not stringing it together. Trump in 2016 was talking about buying Greenland because of strategic geopolitical importance. People laugh. We bought Alaska. We bought the Louisiana Purchase, which is one third of America.
Right.
We bought the Gadsden Purchase from Mexico. It's not unheard of. It's been done before. Lots of countries, the Germans and the Dutch fought over some islands and sold them to each other. It happens. So people laughed about it. They thought it was kind of silly. And it didn't go anywhere because he was dealing with Russia collusion nonsense and things like that, and treason in the House and the Senate. So let's jump forward to this time. He's like, I want to buy Greenland again. Denmark starts fobbing him off. Who are you? And the Greenlanders like, they're ignoring him. So they said, well, we'll just invade. Okay, that's a bit much, but he made a point. But what did happen that people didn't see behind the scenes is Trump threatened Denmark with tariffs, specifically, not the European Union, Denmark. And the reason he threatened them and the reason he wants Greenland is because Denmark has ignored their responsibilities there. So there is virtually no maritime presence from Denmark who owns Greenland to patrol the Arctic Sea. Well, with the summertime having free passage through the Arctic Sea now, which wasn't the case 50 years ago, and the vast trove of minerals and resources under the sea, and the threat to Canada and America's security by Russia and China, Trump wants action. He's looking ahead down the road. So he threatened threatened tariffs against Denmark. And quietly, a few weeks ago, Denmark committed $939 million US to purchase three frigates and build a maritime base in Greenland.
Okay, so there's a result.
That's what he wanted. Okay. So he dropped
Give me another example.
Give me another example. The Chinese, as their Belt and Road Initiative, were in close for the contracts for running the Panama Canal Zone.
Mm-hmm.
Trump said, no. We lost 30,000 Americans there. We gave it back to you for a dollar. The idea was for you to run it for your country, not you to hand it off to somebody else. We're not going to stand for that. We'll just take it back. The Chinese are no longer involved.
Really?
And he threatened tariffs.
They've been booted out completely.
Completely out. They're not part of the contracts. He threatened tariffs. But the press doesn't tell you that. They report it briefly and then move on. Okay. That way they can say they've covered it.
All right.
Here's the third instance. So criminal alien invaders. They're not immigrants. They're not migrants. They're not eating the dogs or cats, but they're not migrants, okay?
They're eating the dogs.
They're eating the cats. Well, the people, the pets of the people of Springfield. That's a whole other story. But they're not immigrants. They're not migrants. Migrants are the H-2A visa holders from South Africa who come to work on our farms, or the Guatemalans who come to pick, you know, artichokes in California.
Yeah, sure.
Those are migrants who they're legally. Immigrants come and present themselves and enter your country legally with the hope of staying there.
These are criminal
criminal alien invaders.
Right.
They violated our sovereignty. Yeah. We are a sovereign nation. South Africa is a sovereign nation. You are entitled to your sovereignty. So Trump is exporting criminal alien invaders now. And they had a bunch of them was going to Colombia. They put them on a C-17. Before any military flight ever leaves the ground, you have to have overflight clearance from every country that you're going over.
And a place to land.
And a place to land. And you don't go unless you have that.
Right.
Unless we're invading a country or bombing it. Cool. So that's the case. So before that flight left the States to carry all those criminals back to Colombia, we're Colombian nationals, we had the approval from the country. Later, we found it was actually the president who gave that approval. Usually, we just go through our embassy, the military attaché does it, and the foreign ministry gives approval. Anyway, the president intervened and said, yes, they can come. He thought he was going to be clever and stand up to Trump and be the great leftist. You know, well, the flight almost got to Colombia. No, you can't land. What? So the C-17.
This is the same president who gave permission.
Correct. But we didn't know he gave permission at the time. He thought he was being clever. So the flight turned around, starts heading back to States. They call. Did you see Trump on the golf course?
Yeah.
25% tariffs. Next week, 50. A week from that, 100% tariffs unless they realign. 1 hour later, Colombia not only called and said, come back and land, which they did, they sent the presidential jet from Colombia to the States to pick up more criminal alien invaders. That's three instances of tariffs working. Now, on this whole thing that's going on now.
Those are all quite strategic. And
well, that's
and
the idea.
With the first two, geographical and geopolitical strategy. So that's important, and it's a good idea. I know that also with China, this is sending panic waves through the Chinese.
Well, China's economy is shambles.
Because they are so dependent on all these other countries buying all the stuff that they're manufacturing, that if their economy craters, if they don't have the kind of growth that they've been sustaining for the last few years.
And they already don't have that without this.
They're going to have a kind of revolution, which is Xi Jinping's worst nightmare.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No, that's exactly right. What's going on.
And so, Taiwan, what are your predictions around that? Because that's a big topic of discussion at the moment. We've got the Taiwan chip manufacturers there who are making pretty much the only advanced microchips in the world. They're in all of our phones, they're in military equipment, they're in all kinds of technology that we absolutely cannot do without. And they're under the ever more ominous looming shadow of China. We hear threats about a soft takeover, an invasion, a lack of U.S. military presence in the South China Sea, which would make it easier for China to make a bold move now. What do you think is going to happen there?
Well, it's a very difficult position because the United States changed our relationship with Taiwan back in the 1970s under Carter once again. Mm. And so we recognize Communist China as legitimate government of
Carter.
Yeah. And it's, I don't recognize it personally in Taiwan. The right. Kuomintang is a legitimate government. I'm sure that'll go over very well with the Chinese
the
ambassador.
Kuomintang. Yeah. Are we going back? Yeah. Well, that's
good. Chiang Kai-shek. You
Chiang Kai-shek.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
So
that's Taiwan.
You know your history too. Yeah. So we've always had a commitment to Taiwan, and we've provided them with the military, the hardware, the jets, the planes, the things that they want, the equipment to defend themselves. But the Chinese have become incredibly cheeky and provocative.
Sure.
They are doing things that are outside the international norm. And people say the same thing about us, but
there
it's
was
not
a
true.
Maneuver last week which caused huge consternation between China and the Philippines.
Well, and just a few weeks back, the Chinese were firing live ammunition towards the Australian shore. The yeah. naval exercise.
Right.
And then last year, they surrounded the island of Taiwan with their Navy and did live fire exercises in the direction of the island.
Taipei, yeah.
The fishermen had to retreat back to shore because live rounds were flying. It's insane what's going on. But I will say this. If China does, the communists invade Taiwan, it will be a bloody, bloody, bloody conflict. Whether the U.S. remains committed is a question. I think under Trump, there's no doubt we'll remain committed. Even under Biden. Biden stood up for Taiwan a few times. That was, but the only time he was awake.
He didn't know.
Yeah, they just,
someone else did it
they
for
just,
him.
They gave him a couple, ketamine or something like that,
By the way, it doesn't seem to make anyone curious at all that no one has seen or heard from him at all. There was a family photo at Easter, which looked like it had been photoshopped. It
probably was.
But Joe Biden has completely disappeared.
So has Kamala Harris.
He's been memory holed. No, well, she made a speech the other day, which was absolutely abominable, to which many people's reply was, oh my God,
Thank goodness.
Fact that a couple of million people voted for this woman is a terrible indictment of the country. But Joe Biden has completely gone off to the nursing home.
Yes.
And no one finds that at all curious or interesting.
Not at all.
There's no picture. There's no recording. There's no nothing. The last time we saw him was the inauguration.
We still hear about Obama all the time, and even Bush occasionally.
Oh, well, they can't help themselves.
Yeah, but we don't hear about Joe, and we probably won't. I mean, he wasn't there when he was there. There's a reason why I play that video. My mind's going blank.
Slippery Pickle says, which Biden exactly? They had various models. All our illegal immigrants hold a general rank in our military too, says Kurtz Verhoeven. All right. So where in the world are you watching with more interest than South Africa? And we'll get to what you think of what's going to happen here, the GNU, because people ask me, and I honestly don't know. I'm not as clued up as you are. But where in the world are you most interested in paying attention to right now? I mean, EU, we've just had elections in Canada and Australia, and they went precisely the way we expect Canada and Australia to go, the wrong way.
The wrong way, yep. Well, in fact, I think the Trump effect has had some role in the Canada.
Oh, big time in both.
Yeah, it's
in both, because it's become
the conservatives would have won this thing for sure.
Right, it's become a proxy election of conservatism versus.
But the liberals have barely won this thing. They didn't win an outright majority. They're gonna have to sort this out unless the numbers.
So you're talking about Carney in Canada?
Yes, Canada. Okay. Yes, yeah, Canada. Yes, sorry.
And a lot of that had to do with him saying 51st state unnecessary. Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, goals. It's funny.
Once.
And we all find it hilarious, but he's going on about it, and it's making older, less humorous Canadians feel like they're put upon.
Exactly. I agree.
And this was a vote against Trump.
It was. It wasn't a vote for the Liberals, a vote against Trump, which is sad because Trudeau has destroyed that country. Canada's gone.
Well, it's going to carry on.
Ireland is gone.
It's going to carry on being destroyed now.
UK is gone. Australia's gone. New Zealand's gone.
I wouldn't want to live in any of those countries.
I wouldn't want to live in those countries either. They're all wonderful countries 30 years ago, and they're all in the crap pit. They're in the bump. Yeah, so it's just a mess. The Trump effect definitely had a role there. But what am I watching? So I'm watching the reciprocal tariffs because this needs to play out the right way. It needs to be a negotiating tactic to get people to look. There are barriers. So here's a perfect example. In Japan, for many years, they forced us for every motorcycle that we exported there. And Japanese love Harley Davidsons. Mm. They love them. They love the 50s culture. It's a big thing there.
Right.
Yeah, they really do. So they love Harley Davidsons. Every motorcycle that shipped to Japan had to be completely disassembled, every part, on arrival.
Really?
That was a barrier that they put in to reduce our shipments of, because you know how many hours it takes to disassemble a motorcycle and how many people you have to pay to put it back together and hope, and then you got to test it again. I mean, right. It's just ludicrous. That's a barrier the country's put in place to keep us from getting goods and services in the country. It's ridiculous. You know, the Europeans charge us 10% tariff plus VAT for each country on top of a car sold in Europe. So there's a reason why there aren't a lot of Chrysler minivans, although the Austrians love Chrysler minivans. Back in the 80s, they had a bunch of them, but the tariffs went up and then they stopped buying them. We charge 2.5% tariffs on European cars. You ship a BMW States,
right? So it's unfair. This is where Trump talks about they're taking advantage of us. That's what he means.
Exactly. So what I would have done is simply raise the tariffs 10% on the Europeans, or 15% to send them a message. I wouldn't have, but I'm not Trump. I'm not the guy in charge.
Sure. So he must have some reason for doing it. He can't have just complete morons around him. I'm just suspicious that it's going to hurt the local economy in America.
Well,
and that will
be
the undoing of his government, because if the cost of living goes up for Americans, if they're forced to pay the price for these tariffs, which is what can happen.
It can, but let me talk about that very quickly.
Then if the economy goes down, then Trump's in big shit.
Well, that's what happens in all politics. It's where the economy is when the election occurs. That's, although this last one was kind of exception with Trump winning, because the economy was doing okay, but Trump won. So on the tariff issue, people talk about tariffs all the time. And there's three points to this. Number one, if the tariff is only raised a certain amount, depending on the supplier of the goods or services, oftentimes they'll eat the cost of the tariff themselves. I'll explain why. If you have a 40% market share shipping mice, you know, computer mice to the States, you don't want to jeopardize that market share.
No.
You don't want to take the risk. So you're going to be willing, if you can afford it with your margins, to eat some of that cost or eat all that cost in the short term to ride the tariff out. So sometimes things will not go up in price because the manufacturer or the distributor will eat the cost.
Okay.
To hope that, and so that will have very negligible or no impact on the domestic consumer. The second issue is that if the tariff is raised a lot, then sometimes they'll eat part of it or half of it so that the price only goes up a little bit for the consumer. And then the third case is that the price goes up and there's no domestic substitution and you have shortages, which could be a problem. But we're already seeing people relenting. The Chinese have already removed the tariffs, the reciprocal tariffs they put on us after we put reciprocal tariffs on them. For semiconductors. They need our semiconductors.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the myth. America is not industrial power. 18% of our GDP is still industry. It's our workforce that's much smaller.
I don't know about you, but I'm almost at my quota for talking about tariffs. I don't have a lot of bandwidth for discussing.
Well, let's move on from that.
There's a question here from Congo Chris, which I think you'll like. Ask Colonel about the Ukraine mineral rights deal. So apparently just this week, Some very different sounds are coming out of the Trump administration from Marco Rubio and from others about the Ukraine. He's been very hostile towards the Ukraine and kind of trying to open the door for Russia, who seem absolutely unwilling to do their part in what's been laid out in front of them here. So it's clear to everybody now that these are the bad guys. And even in the Trump administration, whatever their diplomatic and negotiating skills may be, it seems to me that Russia is unwilling to play its part at this point anyway. And maybe they just need a little bit more pressure. However, the deal that has been struck now seems to be a very good one for both America and for the Ukraine. They will bounce off against rare earth minerals the cost of military equipment. Ukraine will get the military equipment it needs to continue the war, and America will get the much needed rare earths, which they will not get from China anymore. China's not sending rare earths, gallium, germanium, various other metals and minerals that you would need for complicated technological developments and reconstructions and constructions and manufacturing processes. So this is a good deal for both America and the Ukraine. What do you make of it?
Well, it's an interesting topic. This is, you know, the thing about Trump you have to understand, and I'm sure you understand, but people need to focus on, is that Trump is a transactional person. Go back to The Art of the Deal, book he wrote back in the 80s. It's funny because Malema just said he's illiterate, but he wrote a book in the 80s. I don't know how that works, but anyway.
Yeah.
So
this is Julius Malema has never written anything more than, more than a page of
rhetoric. I heard he got a D in woodworking last I heard, but anyway. So I'm not sure how you manage that. It's not hard to cut wood. Anyway, so Trump is a deal maker. That's what he's all about. He's about making deals, and that's what it's always been. And so I think that's been a big part of his foreign policy and his diplomacy. But I was puzzled by this. But when it first came up, people were trashing it. And I said, well, think about this for a second. America doesn't have skin in the game. We've given Ukraine like $250 billion.
Yeah.
It's insane. Huge. And Zelensky tries to come back and say, well, no, that was grant money. No. Most of that was loans. I know, because we were giving the money. I always wanted to be up in arms and angry about it, make a big deal about why we're giving all this money to Ukraine, but not to Africa or not to other countries. And I would look at the aid, and most of it was loans. A little bit was grants, but most of it was. So if you give them a loan, I really, you know, we expect to be paid back. So Trump said, you know, what we need to do is have skin in the game. We have to have a reason for the U.S. to want to be involved in Ukraine, because we're not. There's not much of involvement there other than giving them weapons to kill each other. So the minerals thing, rare earths, gives us skin in the game. So we have a vested interest in getting peace in Ukraine.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, from a strategic standpoint, that actually makes sense. If it's to pay for military equipment, I'm not so thrilled with that concept. I mean, there's enough dead people in Ukraine and Russia now.
Oh, I think
it needs to stop.
I think across the board, with the exception of the two main players here, everybody else in the world would love this thing to come to an end.
I agree.
And it's not as if Zelensky and Putin are just wanting death everywhere. They have various motivations for the things that they're already doing. I've heard quite a lot from both sides of the argument. And it's hard to find a positive argument from the Russian side because they've been shut down everywhere.
Yeah, you don't
hear anything
from
them. I'm not saying that I'm sympathetic to Russia at all, but it's very hard to hear their point of view. And you need to be able to hear both. You know, RT's been shut down everywhere, including
in
this country.
States. The States have been shut down as well.
And so the only things we hear are kind of highly propagandized or propagandized by the other side. It's difficult to make up your mind. I see a point from Charles von Onselen here. Trump had to make a deal in Ukraine in order to justify its loans and also justifies its involvement in the conflict by having a dog in the fight. Tariffs were a sounding board for Trump. And Russia do not want peace, is what he says.
Oh, I agree 100%. Charles is one of my viewers. I call him the voice of reason.
No, smart guy. All right, so Alert South Africa says, why are you guys not talking about the Poppy Act? It's the same system communist countries use to suppress information. You want to talk about the Poppy Act?
Well, that's
maybe
South
we're not
African
talking about it because it's, yeah, I mean, look.
You mean maybe in the context of Kyle Cowen and outing Twitterbus? Is that where that's coming
from? Well, let's just talk about that because I only figured that out a day or two later than everybody else. So who is this guy who was outed by News 24? A private citizen?
Correct. Is he a subject of a criminal investigation? Not that we know publicly. Has he committed a crime? Not that we're aware of. So why is he being outed? Because he said things they didn't like.
So hang on. News 24, a powerful mainstream news outlet, which has millions of subscribers. I mean, they're dropping like flies, but
they are.
Have millions of subscribers. These people, with malice aforethought, decided to publish the personal details of someone who was using an alias on Twitter.
Which is his prerogative.
Sure, there are lots of people who do that. Some of them much, much worse people from what I can
gather. Much more powerful than this guy.
Some of them actively aiding and abetting terrorism in various parts of the world. And this was justified by them how?
their argument was that this is an influential account that has influenced Donald Trump. And if they actually believe that, they're brain dead. Trump is not being influenced by that account. He's not also not.
But then, if Trump is being influenced by a South African.
So what?
So, I mean, what are you going to do about it? It's not your job. What does it matter? News organization. You're not the intelligence arm of the South African government.
Well, that's the thing that's so comical about this. I mean, you know, I spent 30 years in the intelligence community and I've worked at all levels, tactical up to writing for the president of the United States. And for these people at News 24 to think that that Twitter account, because Elon Musk retweeted something from there 24 times, is influencing Donald Trump. Have they not heard the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Department of Energy, you know, all the State Department, all these organizations have intelligence officials that brief the president on a daily basis. He's getting his information from the intelligence community and some people outside of it, not from, you know, anonymous Twitter accounts in South Africa. That's really not where he's getting his information. And they see that as a threat. And maybe that's because of their abysmal reporting.
Yeah, I think that they've just embarrassed themselves so many times. My favorite example of that is still when they called Jan Breyer a racist on Heritage Day because he only gave Boerewors roles.
That was last year,
to white people,
which wasn't even true.
It was such bullshit. I mean, News 24 is just a disgrace. Anyway, Charles Van Onselen does say. Puppy Act is a meh, more like a distraction. News 24 need to be held accountable for their actions. Absolutely. But I do find the Puppy Act is a completely wasteful topic of discussion because they're giving our information out anyway. I mean, how many days of the week do I get a call from an insurance company or a bank or some other financial institution offering me stuff? They could only have got that information from one of the places which is meant to comply with the Puppy Act and clearly doesn't. So why the hell should the rest of us? I say when you're asked to fill in those forms, when you're doing a contract or whatever it was with whoever, I think you should just refuse. It's like when I go into someone's estate or I drive into a business park, I don't fill in my actual details. Neither should you. They're selling that information and you shouldn't be a part of that pyramid scheme.
Well, I don't disagree, but I mean, there's lots of things that make no sense. I mean, the South African Human Rights Commission makes no sense.
Oh,
I mean, their actions with Knobs Mkhize. What's going on there? Yeah. She lost her job at SABC, but I don't know that she's been barred from flying. She assaulted people on a flight in flight.
That's true.
That's usually a bar. I mean, that's also a criminal offense. Nothing's happened there. No. We've seen nothing with Nota Boloye's shameful, disgraceful conduct. He's actually watching my videos. Hi, Noita. How you doing there?
Oh, really? He's become a fan. Yeah. Huh?
He's commenting on my videos, but we've seen nothing with that. The list goes on, yet they're still dementedly going after Ronaldo Jos over a 15-year-old video, which was an academic lesson that was distorted and misused by his political opponents, probably within his own party, by my own estimation, who wanted him cut down. Some people didn't like him. But that case is still ongoing. Ronaldo's still paying lawyer fees to fight a case. What's going on with Knobs Mkhize? What's going on with Nota Boloye and all these other people who've committed egregious offenses?
But don't you know, Chris, how long haven't you been in South Africa long enough to know that if you're black, you can't be committing human rights abuses and you can't possibly be racist? Come on.
It's not a question. What's wrong with you? Not a question I know. It's a question of calling out the hypocrisy.
Okay. So Michelle says that is the backstory to the Russian involvement. The Ukraine has been the problem. There's a lot of that. There's people just they fall into one or two camps and they defend their side.
Well, I fall in the middle because both sides are guilty. Both sides are guilty of the war starting. Russia's at fault for starting the war, but Ukraine contributed to the conditions that caused the war to happen. There's no innocent parties here except the people dying in the trenches and the civilians are being bombed. These political leaders are horrible people.
All right. Well, we seem to have lots of other questions, but I'm not going to get into them because we're at 8 o'clock already, and I appreciate your time, sir. It's always good to have you around, and I'm delighted that you will also be part of what we're going to be doing along with Rob Hersov and a bunch of other people called the Truth Report, which will be launching soon.
Am I?
Yes.
Where did you hear that?
Come on.
I can neither confirm nor deny
them,
that
don't
rumor.
Make them think that we're as disorganized as we are.
Sounds like fake news to me.
Yes, Colonel Chris Wyatt, thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure.
Very nice to see you. Bitcoin Butt says, where's the meet and greet? He wants to meet and greet you.
We're trying to set one up for Prison Break tomorrow. I haven't set the time.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
okay.
So, but Prison Break Tuesday, probably early afternoon.
Just by the way, for people who don't know, that's not he's not going to be breaking out of prison. He's never been locked up. But it is a place called Prison Break opposite the Lone Hill Prison on the Witkoppen Road?
It's in Four Ways.
Yeah. So like near Witkoppen, sort of Lone Hill area. All right. Thanks, everybody. That's all we got time for this morning. Apologies about the technical issues that we had at the beginning. We seem to have ironed those out. And thank you, James and Flex, for making a big effort to get that done. We will be back on Wednesday because it's a normal week. Yay, 5-day weeks. So we're back on Wednesday and Friday, and have a good week. There's lots of other good stuff you can check out on The Real Network. And don't forget to go and see Chris's own channel. If you aren't already a subscriber there, go and join him. You get lots of really, really good, unique information out of the man. He knows his stuff. Ciao. We'll see you on Wednesday.